When all is ready, I throw this switch.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to The Collected Edition, a comic book podcast where we discuss the famous and infamous runs and story arcs throughout the history of comics. I am Paul Matthew Carr, and with me, as always, Brian Reese.
Happy Thanksgiving, everybody.
Yes, happy Thanksgiving. Oh, this will be coming out right around the Thanksgiving time. Hey,
it
nice.
It shall indeed.
Unless I forget, and then...
Merry Christmas!
What a beautiful summer arriving.
Yeah.
Today on the program, we will be discussing one of the seminal works of comic book history, the Dark Phoenix Saga.
Bum, bum, bum.
I know. And you know what? We say things like that, like it's epic or it's seminal. This literally is just one of the pinnacle works in the great pantheon of comic book stories.
Yes.
This one sits atop it.
This is kind of up there if we did, Watchmen or Dark Knight Returns or Sandman. Insert your favorite evergreen title in here, although this is less issues than those.
That's true, which I have thoughts on. Yes, it's less issues than those, but definitely has just as many words.
And maybe more. maybe not Sandman. There's a lot of words in Sandman.
Yes. But first, before we discuss the epic that is the Dark Phoenix Saga, we have a couple things we just want to talk about, not really news-related, but just some thoughts on things that came up in this while reading this collection. First of all, Brian, you wanted to talk about thought balloons. You had thoughts on balloons.
I miss thought balloons. I mean, it's so one of the great things, and you know, we may or may not talk about this during the discussion of the comic, is there is so much about this, about the Dark Phoenix saga, that is run by the thought balloon, that narratively are so, there's a whole scene towards the end of this where it is page after page of the various X-Men ruminating the nature of Jean Grey and Phoenix and how they react to the information that they're provided and what they are about to face towards the end of these comics. And it's all thought balloon. I get in some ways certain writers decided they didn't want to use that anymore, that they would use the exposition in letterboxes. But I don't think that works. And I mean, it works. It works for the way the writers write that. But the fact that they've kind of completely gotten rid of the thought balloon has removed the internal dialogue. And I think that that has changed the nature of comics.
Yes. Well, you see now, well, they'll have the letterbox.
Right.
But it'll be different colors for the different person's thoughts, which is essentially a thought balloon, except...
It's a clunky box.
Yeah. It's a different art style, and I understand why modern artists have decided to go in that direction.
Right.
Because it breaks up the panel differently. It breaks up the page differently. Right. And you can do some pretty interesting things with it. But narratively, I'm kind of on your side with this, and especially in this, and I guess when we just have our main discussion, we'll talk about it. But the way Claremont uses thought bubbles is he will have the thought that folds into what they said out loud and then into a thought again.
Yes.
Which works incredibly well to see what the internal feelings are and then what they say out loud.
It's a great narrative technique that I don't think that the letterbox can replicate.
Yeah, it doesn't convey the same idea, the same feeling.
But I think it changed the nature of storytelling.
Yeah, well, yeah, the way comics are told now is much different from the way they were told just 10 years ago.
Like, losing the thought bubble led to the excessive deconstruction that we have now in certain comics.
Yeah, well, that will be the argument against us, which will be, you know, these internal thoughts are conveyed through body language and facial expression, and it's more art driven, which I get because, yes, the older comics are a bit wordy. However, I don't mind reading. I think that's a good thing. And I think it went too far in the opposite direction. And we give on this show, we give Bendis a lot of short shrift, but he goes to say nothing for pages at a time, which, you know, I could use a few words every once in a while. But no, I just, like I said, it's a different technique. It's a different style of telling stories, which, you know, it's all personal preference.
Right.
Yeah.
And I love modern comics. There's so many modern comics that are great. You know, there's so much good, interesting stuff happening in comics. I don't, the loss of the thought bubble hasn't destroyed comics. I don't want to come out as sounding like one of those.
No, it completely ruined comics. It's, you know, hashtag not my comics. And right.
It's not that, because writers have found other ways to communicate. But at the same time, just the fact that it's completely gone.
You'll see it every once in a while.
You see it pop up now and again. But it feels as if things change. Art changes. The way that things are presented changes. There's nothing wrong with that. Forward movement is great. As a matter of fact, we might even comment on that in the comic coming up when we talk about entropy. But it feels like there's still a place for it. And I feel like writers should be allowed to use it.
Yeah. I kind of think...
And I don't know if they're just not allowed anymore, or if no current writers, I can't imagine that no current writers have zero interest in the thought bubble. Maybe I'm wrong.
I kind of, and this is just my thoughts on this. As we moved, as comics became legitimate, mm-hmm. you know, from not just kids stuff that grownups read to actual considered literature, graphic novels, using the thought balloon seems childish. Or looks childish to an outsider.
Sure.
It's like, oh, and
I get that.
I think that, you know, they were trying to move it into a more artistic and right. more legitimate style of storytelling, which I kind of get, but at the same time, you know, this is the medium and let's not be ashamed of what it does.
Exactly.
You know, it's a legit, like the thought balloon is a legitimate form of storytelling within this genre, within this medium, and it should mm-hmm. be embraced. You don't have to use it all the time.
Right.
But
and it's also it exists in literature all over the place. It's called quotes. But I mean, quotes are also people speaking out loud. But in literature, even in contemporary literature, there's tons of internal thought going on.
Yeah, if you've ever read
on what person narrative, obviously you have different, you know, first, third person narrative, so it doesn't always exist in every, but it's still internal life is still represented in literature.
Yes, absolutely. And if you ever read a Stephen King novel, he likes to use italics when someone's thinking.
Mm-hmm.
And so it's the same kind of idea.
Right.
Except, you know, in comics, it's represented visually. Yeah. I think it is a legitimate and very cool artistic technique.
I'm not cranky or old enough to be like, you know, waving my stick at the sky, like complaining about something dumb. But, you know, it'd be nice to see it utilized now and again in a way that makes sense.
Absolutely. And maybe shake it up a little bit. Maybe try to use a little bit of a, you know, use it, but do it, render it differently in the new modern art styles.
And I get the visual artists don't want their art covered up.
There was a thing. So back in the 60s, Kirby used to get mad at Stan Lee. Stan Lee would just put blocks and blocks and blocks of text all around the picture.
Yeah.
And Kirby would be like, dude, you're covering up everything. Like,
I just spent hours on this.
Exactly.
Or well, day.
Well, it was Kirby. I just spent 5 minutes on this.
Oh, there we go.
He was very good. I'm not saying that he was a bad artist. He was so good he could do it quickly. Yeah. Just to head that off at the past, stop typing the comment. Anyway, yeah, so... Thought balloons, they're good. Bring them back. This is our ongoing series. I think we've talked about this a dozen times.
We've probably mentioned it before, but you know, they're so important in this series in a particular sequence that happens towards the end. You have every single X-Men reflecting their feelings about Jean Grey and the Phoenix, that just having them blarg out, like it's their internal dialogue and it's really intriguing.
Yeah, it is. It is utilized incredibly well by writer Chris Claremont, which brings me to our next subject, which is what I wanted to talk about, the importance of Chris Claremont to comics. So this is what I was thinking, Brian, as I was reading this. Chris Claremont is given, you know, everyone loves him. He's given his kudos and his praise.
Right.
So it's not like he's underrated or unknown or dismissed. Everyone loves Chris Claremont, but I don't think he's given enough appreciation for just how much he has shaped the Marvel Comics world.
Right.
Because, you know, there's Lee and Kirby and Ditko and others are all held up of these, like, oh, they created the Marvel Universe. But Claremont, he didn't create the Marvel Universe, but he refined it into what it is today. I don't know if you agree with that or not. Yeah,
I do. And the idea that he took a dead franchise and revised it and revitalized it almost, like, you could almost say overnight.
You know, throughout the 80s, it was the X-Men comics were the number one comics in the world, best-selling comics.
Yeah.
They were a phenomenon.
Yeah.
And it was all because of Claremont and how he structured and created these things. The litany, or the list of characters he created.
It's insane.
It's insane. You just
Wikipedia it because that's all you could do.
Yeah, go to Wikipedia and see the list of characters he created. You're going to go, damn.
It's nuts.
So he took over the X-Men in 75 and wrote it continuously up until, was it 91 or 92?
I think 91.
But that's phenomenal to work on a single title for that long.
Nobody does that.
And to be at incredibly high quality and consistency. The way he... So here's Claremont. And again, we're going to talk about this when we talk about this story. But the interweaving of narratives, the building of payoff. Because what we're going to talk about is a handful of issues that are the culmination of a storyline that has been going on for 5-6 years.
And also things in it that are building towards things that we don't even see for another couple years.
Exactly. You know, and the plates he kept spinning, it's incredible. Yes. And he takes some criticism for purple prose and soap opera narratives, but those things are what made this title so popular.
Right. It's the soap opera. So Marvel's always had a soap opera nature to it. Right. Yes. And I, this will be in my intro and in other places where I reference this too. So his approach, what was interesting, like, as I read up, like, I know about Chris Claremont. Of course, I read up more on him and in various places. You know, the fact that he was an actor and the fact that he was interested in theater and that he was interested in various sort of literary pursuits and interests outside of the comics world before he really kind of found himself suddenly just thrown into comics. And the fact that that approach is how what he brought to the X-Men, the soapy nature of Marvel Comics, he took to a whole nother level.
Yeah, he took it to an extreme, but a good extreme.
Yeah, it wasn't just world building. Every character he created, he had as an actor, he inhabited those characters. And as actors often do, they give their characters backstories, even though if they're never represented on the page or in film or on television or whatever medium, he took that idea and absolutely spread it out over 12, 13, 14 years.
Yeah, absolutely.
And like you said, he was like juggling plates, or I'm not sure if that's exactly what you said, but like he was doing that with all those characters. Every single one he created had a real story behind them, some of which you never saw, but he developed in a way that very few creators do.
Absolutely. And he gave it an international feel.
Right.
Or it wasn't just, you know, East Coast United States. He had characters from all over the world. Now, yeah, some of them are cliche, sure, but that's the nature of storytelling.
Right. His creation of, like, he created lots of strong female characters.
Oh, yeah.
Lots and lots of strong female characters. He also had some ick with some of the female characters. One of whom Kitty Pryde will discuss when we hit this comic.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, you know, he was creating female characters in a way that no other male creators in popular comics. I need to like do a lot of clarification there. Male creators in mainstream comics. He was creating female characters in that particular world that other creators were not doing in that particular world.
Right.
Ooh, that's a lot of caveats. But you know what I mean.
Yeah, no, I know exactly what you mean. And even when, I know you talk about ick, but something like the White Queen, who we'll get into, you could see that as the way she's dressed and the way she acts is sort of exploitative. However, the character also owns it and
right.
and uses it. And I don't know. I mean, maybe...
She's a boss.
Yeah. You know.
And she continued and has continued to be a boss.
Exactly. Let's not get into specifics about the story yet, because that's for after the break. I just wanted to say Chris Claremont, man, he's recognized as one of the greats in comics, but he should be really recognized as what Marvel Comics is today really comes from how he reshaped and we've talked about this in the past. 70s Marvel was chaos, and he came in and added stability,
right,
and added a template with which to follow.
Here's a challenge, right? It's tell me another Marvel creator, writer, who have been as important outside of Stan Lee, who have been important to Marvel Comics as much as Chris Claremont. What writer has created a legacy to that extent? We could talk about, you know, Roy Thomas. We could talk about some others.
Yeah, Wolfman and so forth. Yeah,
Wolfman, what have you. But to the extent that Claremont did.
Yeah, that's what I mean, is that Claremont came in and totally revitalized and changed how Marvel does business.
Yeah.
And then you couple that with the business acumen of say, Shooter.
Right.
And stuff changed, man. And, you know, let's not forget John Byrne, who we'll talk about right. quite a bit again, coming up too.
Sure. I mean, John Byrne's important too, but I don't know if John Byrne's legacy is even equal to Claremont's. Again, this is a wonderful case for argument. I may not disagree with people who disagree with me.
Yeah.
I'm happy for some great examples otherwise.
Yeah.
And I think there are great examples otherwise, but don't come at me with Bendis, please.
No. I mean, the whole point I brought this up was because I agree with you. Claremont just changed. He changed how Marvel did business.
Yeah.
Writing wise and, you know, storytelling and selling comics. So,
yeah.
Plus, he's the guy who spun everything off and started doing, let's do crossovers. And
well, and that's not my favorite part of his legacy.
At the same time, when he was doing that stuff, it was new and exciting. And yeah. Yes, it spun out of control, but that's not his fault. I guess to sum up, Chris Claremont, he's good.
Yeah.
Okay.
Also, by all accounts, one of the most genuinely nice guys in the business.
Yes, which is so good. Yeah. It's so nice.
At least based on, I've never met him. I don't know. I can't speak to that. But from... he's up there with Walt Simonson in terms of how people speak about
some of the... his appearances at Comic Cons and various functions, and by all accounts, he's a very, very nice man. Which is that so hard? Can we just have nice people?
We just found out recently that we can't.
Fair enough. Okay. On that note, let's take a break. You just mentioned the rise of the Dark Phoenix. Let's use that as a jumping off point. Let's take a break, right. Come back, and we'll talk about the epic that is the Dark Phoenix.
Song. Yes.
And we're back. Brian, this week, it is your choice, the epic choice of a lifetime. Can you tell us all about it?
Certainly I can. Death is inevitable. Entropy will have its way. Whether through violence or the slow march of time and decay, all things will cease, and civilizations and worlds will be turned to dust until all that is will be merely a silence that cannot travel through a soundless void of nothingness. But while we ponder this lovely thought, we also turn to ideas of rebirth, the need to believe that life, in all its myriad of forms, is stronger than entropy, that the sheer will of existence is mightier than the maw of nothingness. Many, but not all, cultures, religions, and philosophies feature the concept of continuance, that which is dead can be transformed, whether through reincarnation, elevation to higher planes of existence, rebirth, etc., ad infinitum. And infinitum is indeed the hope we hold. So, consider, if you will, the phoenix, how it shines. With roots in ancient Greek, Persian, and Egyptian mythology, the phoenix is an analog of rebirth, a bird that literally flames out and, yes, rises again from the ashes. Not a particularly subtle motif, but with many complex underpinnings. The long-ranging signifiers aren't necessarily germane to a comic book podcast, but suffice to say that mankind has always looked to continued existential renewal. It would be silly of me to attempt a history of the X-Men and Jean Grey Phoenix in particular. Many of our millions of listeners are much more versed in X-lore than I am. I have never been the most loyal of X-fans, though I did read religiously through the 80s before abandoning the overwhelming number of crossovers and titles. But to our topic today, the Dark Phoenix Saga, which runs from issues 129 to 137, is widely considered one of the greatest X-Men story arcs in its history. It certainly hit within the most classic of the X-Men runs, with Chris Claremont and John Byrne at the very peak of their storytelling prowess, and at their soapiest. What is remarkable about these few brief issues is how seminal the events have become, even today, 40 plus years later. The Dark Phoenix Saga introduced Kitty Pryde, Dazzler, the Hellfire Club, particularly the constantly shirtless Sebastian Shaw, and Emma Frost, the White Queen and her lingerie, and Senator Robert Kelly and the threat of the return of the Sentinels. Claremont doing Claremont. But the crux, of course, is the journey of Jean Grey. When the Phoenix entity was first introduced, it was used in the capacity for good, the entropic nature used for good and the preservation of life. But the dissociative nature of a universal force residing in a young human still developing their own mighty powers becomes existential, and a mind can only take so much, particularly when already broken by less powerful beings. And so we have a conflict of will. Did Claremont and Byrne do dirty by Jean Grey? Would they have imbued a more powerful resistance on a different character, say, Wolverine? Hard to tell. But the primary underpinning narrative, amongst the soapier aspects and the massive fight scenes, is Jean Grey's struggle with identity and autonomy, and also the Phoenix's hunger and desire. How these internal conflicts resolve is ultimately tragic. For 5 billion living beings, for Jean Grey herself, and for those that loved and valued her. Jean Grey commits suicide. There's no way to sugarcoat that. And thus, entropy and rebirth begin the cycle anew. And so many Phoenix deaths and rebirths to come endlessly, which may be the point. Heavy shit in a comic book for kids in the late 70s, early 80s. But further proof that big ideas can exist in a medium still not respected outside of niche. Chris Claremont's entire run on X-Men pushed boundaries in ways that will be important for a long time. The Dark Phoenix Saga is a jewel on the cap, with layers upon layers that many folks can discover and rediscover anew from the ashes. It should also be noted that the correct version of the ever-loving Beast has a really important return to the X-World, loaned from the Avengers, and serves as a moral center. They also let him utter, at one point, "Oh, my stars and gars," and all is well. So, Paul, I recommended this. We read it, probably for the 50th or 60th time in our lives. Thoughts, feelings?
First of all, heavy shit indeed. I concur. Yeah, this is just good. So it's been a while. It's been a minute, as the kids say. And holy, I was just blown away by how really, really good this is. It's tight. It's well-paced. There's a lot of information, but you never feel lost. At least I didn't feel lost in it. This is just good. All right. Thanks, everybody.
All right. There we go. So read Dark Phoenix Saga, and we'll see you next week when we talk about the Scarlet Witch.
Yes. Hey, spoiler. Wait, you know what? I'm gonna jump off of what you just said. If anyone hasn't read this, the Dark Phoenix Saga, the original, go do it now. Turn off this podcast, go read it, and then come back to us later. Because as intellectually stimulating as we are, we're not going to do justice to how just genuinely good this story is. But I mean, Emma, just to think about how many new things were introduced, how many new concepts, and the moral implications and the ethical implications, and God, this is just storytelling, comic book storytelling at its finest.
Yeah. And what is also, like, when you said stop listening to us and go read it, the important thing to note is that you don't need to know anything before reading this from X-Men lore.
No.
Because whatever you don't know is taken care of in the narrative. You are given the information you need, whether it be editor's notes or Chris Claremont's writing. You can start here and pick up everything you need to know.
Yeah.
You will not be lost. It's not like trying to read Hickman's run on X-Men. You will not have to have any knowledge before starting this.
Yeah. And I want to...
This is a sign of a good writer.
Absolutely. And I want to also give a shout out to John Byrne in that way too, because, to put it in a very professional way, he draws the shit out of this.
Yes, he does.
It's amazing. And you get, and the facial expressions and the way characters react to each other visually also conveys a lot of backstory.
Yes.
So Claremont holds your hand, you get editorial notes, and then you have Byrne visually conveying how characters interact with each other.
He's showing, not telling.
Absolutely. Absolutely. It's brilliant. Also, that that being said, so this story has been adapted multiple times in live action and in animation,
right?
And at least for the live action versions, hasn't been done that well. And I think in part a lot of that is in part due to the fact that this is the culmination of a lot of stuff going on. It is a soap opera. So Claremont has created these characters, he's created their dynamic, and he's built this long story arc so that when you get to the Dark Phoenix, it's devastating.
Yes.
Whereas in the movie, it happens and you go, that's whatever, I don't care. But in this, it you feel that the pain that the characters feel, Scott and Wolverine and Logan, I should say, and all the characters. When Jean falls to the dark side, as you want to say, you feel their pain. You feel like this is their friend that they have lost. This is someone that they love, either romantically or platonically. But good Lord, it's just I'm just going to Chris Farley this all the way through. It's just so good.
Well, it is, and trying to avoid the Chris Farley aspect of this, there is a lot in the earlier issues. Like, we could go story beat by story beat if you all have 4 to 5 hours to kill. We don't. I'm assuming our millions of listeners don't either. So we could spend an hour on each issue. That's how packed.
Yes, it is dense storytelling. But we're not going to do that.
Again, what it does is it lends itself to, like you said, it's like, if you've been reading all along up until this point, you have a strong sense of what Jean Grey means to the individual members of the X-Men. If you haven't been, Claremont does a great job in the first 4 or 5 issues of this arc to build that up for new readers.
Yes, absolutely. Yeah, so you don't have to have been reading all along. You'll get the story and you'll get the emotional impact of it. But if you have been reading all along, it is so rewarding. And it is a tragedy. This is a Greek tragedy. Anyway, good stuff. So I don't know. So let's just tell the listeners how we're going to approach this. I think the first few issues we're just going to kind of give the highlights to.
Right. I mean, the first 4 or 5 issues are important in many ways, because what they do is they build up again. It's part of the world building, and these are important because essentially we start off with Cerebro has identified two new mutants. Those two mutants happen to be named Kitty Pryde and Dazzler.
Kitty Pryde, who will probably become one of the biggest fan favorites of all of X-Men. There are those who have problems with Kitty Pryde, but those people, you're wrong. She's wonderful. We also get the return of Charles Xavier, who has been gallivanting with the Shi'ar Empire. And then we get a little a foreshadowing that the Shi'ar will come back.
But we also get, you know, Professor X returns. Like, so he has turned over the X-Men to Scott Summers, Cyclops, yes. Which makes sense. People have various feelings about Cyclops, Scott Summers. I'm one of those. Never one of my favorite characters. But is he the natural person to take over leadership of the X-Men? Yes, he is. And what he is also dealing with, and what we see in these first several issues, is he is dealing with a new team that Professor X did not raise and train.
Right. He's still trying to, Charles Xavier is still trying to train them as if they were kids.
As if they're Angel and Jean and Hank and Scott. And these are not the same people. As Scott Summers points out, Wolverine is a grown-ass man.
Yeah, who's been alive for a very long time.
Right.
Yes.
Aurora is a grown-ass woman.
Yes, as a grown-ass woman who's been worshipped as a goddess most of her life.
Yes.
So she doesn't need that crap from him.
Right. And we see, like, with the return of Professor X, he gets all fussy with Scott about how he is how Scott is leading these new uncanny X-Men. You know, it's a little bit of Johnny come lately. Scott points out to him at numerous times that this is a different team. This is not the same X-Men. This is the all new, all different, all exceptional. The universe will never be the same X-Men.
That's right. And Professor X is, you know, he's an absentee father. And Scott points that out to him. It's like, where have you been?
And the fact that Wolverine will take orders from Scott.
Exactly.
And is not taken into account by Professor X.
Yes. And so, Wolverine, he just storms out. You know, he doesn't take any guff from Charles.
Right. He ain't having it.
He's a little short with him. Thank you very much.
You figure he's clawed his way up in life. So there is a dynamic being presented here. We also have to note that one of the important things is Professor X does not have the same psychic link with the X-Men that he used to have. And this is a big issue. He can't connect to them psychically in the same way that he could connect to the previous iteration of the X-Men.
And this is actually a brilliant thing. The X-Men have always been, you know, used as a metaphor or an allegory for, you know, be it race issues or some, you know.
Well, and also, you know, in some ways there was some strong LGBTQ before we had those phrases, but
yeah.
That's the other being oppressed by society.
Yeah, and that's exactly what I was going to get to, which was Claremont took that idea and ran with it and just used it in every manner you could possibly imagine. Like this, for instance, the older teacher, the older father figure cannot connect with the younger kids anymore.
Right.
And that's a brilliant little moment. It's told as, I can't psychically connect, our minds can't connect anymore.
Right.
But it's the younger generation is growing up and taking over.
Well, and that Jean Grey has progressed beyond where Professor X can
control. Let's just say that.
I was going to use the word control. I was going to use that cautiously. But yes, he can't control her anymore.
Yeah.
Oh, my goodness, the levels involved there.
And we're going to see this a lot with older males trying to control Jean.
Yes.
In various ways. From Professor X to Scott, It's only when, okay, we'll get it later, but only when Scott gives up his control that Phoenix can be saved. but you know, but also Wingard, Wingard.
We'll get, yeah.
Yeah. Wingard. And just, yeah, the levels of men trying to control women in this is significant, let's say.
Right. Well, and how Claremont delineates that, and how even a dude writing at this in this time period, we can look back and be like, there's some creepy aspects here, but it's really ahead of its time.
Oh, yeah. Claremont, yeah, ahead of the curve.
You know, looking back on it now, would Claremont do things differently if he was writing this now? Yes. Yes, he would. I'm certain. Well, I don't want to speak for him. I can't speak.
Well, he does. I mean, you can look at his work now. He's still working.
Yeah.
He's still writing. And his work now is evolved indifferently because things change.
Right. But my goodness.
Yeah, at the time, he was way ahead of you know, leaps and bounds ahead of what other writers were doing at the time.
Especially some of the more troglodyte writers at the time. And I'm not going to name names, but we all know. And so this is what these first few issues sort of start to establish. And there's a lot of things that happen in these first few issues. Of importance, of course, is the introduction of Kitty Pryde. There's a little bit of creepiness between the fact that she's 13 and is already crushing on Peter Colossus, who is an adult. And this has been a continued bone of contention within the X world. This is not the podcast to discuss that, but I do want to acknowledge it.
To be fair, at least in these issues, Colossus is not reciprocating.
Right. Yes.
He's just sort of going, okay. You know, every time she tries to compliment him, she's like, okay, thank you, I guess. So it's not as creepy as it could have been.
Right. So, you know, what's great about these issues is what we are introduced. So we get this dynamic between Professor X and the other X-Men. We get the dynamic between Scott Summers and Jean Grey. Again, this is the great sort of subtlety that exists in his writing. We are seeing the slow rise of Phoenix, and it's just in like individual panels or an individual thought bubble, or you start to see the seeds of the conflict that she's having. You also start to see the seeds of Scott becoming concerned about certain aspects of how Jean is using her power. In the midst of all this, I mean, these are just little things that are being like placed randomly within the larger. There's a lot of fight scenes. This is the X-Men. We get tons of fight scenes that John Byrne absolutely blows out of the water. This is superhero comics. The soap opera stuff is great, but at the end of the day, we also want fight scenes. So within these issues, so we get these seeds starting to germinate. We are introduced to Kitty Pryde. We are introduced to Dazzler in some really great moments, kind of funny moments, some of it. And we are introduced to the Hellfire Club. I mean, so many of the X-Men's greatest hits start here.
As this is going on, you see Jean Grey having these, what she thinks are flashbacks, but they're illusions. She's living in the past.
1700s. It's a little unclear sometimes.
You know, we could say that because this is an illusion and because her mind isn't processing this correctly, it does get confusing, and the time periods kind of jump around and the So
at some point we're in revolutionary time, and then at some point there they tell us that it's more of a 1800s
Southern genteel priest antebellum time, you know.
Right. But what we get is Jason Wingard, who is a member of the Hellfire Club, who we find out 3 or 4 or 5 issues down the line is actually Mastermind, is manipulating Jean Grey, because what the Hellfire Club wants, we find out, what they want to do is, and it's stated explicitly by Sebastian Shaw at some point, is to use the X-Men for genetic manipulation.
Right. They want to create their own super race of mutants.
For capitalistic gains.
And I believe Sebastian Shaw also wants to pass a law where shirts are not required.
Yes.
Yes.
Because anytime he has to get into a fight, off comes the shirt.
Absolutely.
I mean, every time. It's amazing he has time. Like if I was in a fight, I'd just start punching, right? You know, it's like I've only been in one fight in my life when I was in second grade, so I don't really know how it works. But I assume that when you're scrapping, you want to get right in there and go at it,
Well,
right? You
maybe he
think
has like Chippendales breakaway shirts where he just pulls it, it comes right off. You never get
Every
to.
time he has to like battle, the shirt's got to come off. Yeah, so it's this idea that like, so is Wingard, aka Mastermind, manipulating Jean Grey to access the Phoenix Force, or is he manipulating Jean Grey just to access the X-Men for the use of the Hellfire Club? And that gets a little tricky, which I like. I appreciate that it's not explicit. At some point, the Phoenix does become part of the narrative through numerous issues and a lot of really awful mind manipulation. She eventually becomes like the Dark Queen.
Exactly. No, this is really good because all the members of the Hellfire Club aren't, they aren't just this one group of evil people. They each have their own agenda.
Right.
And if they have to screw someone else over to get it, well, that then they will. So what is Jean being used for? It depends on the person. I think the main fact is that everyone wants to use Jean for their own purposes.
Yes,
Yes.
which is icky in so many ways.
Yes, intentionally so.
Intentionally so. I mean, it is, again, with the exception of Emma Frost, it is all done by men. You know, one could argue this is one of my arguments with Scott Summers, it's always been. He hasn't always been, and Wolverine as well. Neither of them have always been the most noble or forward thinking in terms of Jean Grey as a human.
And to be fair to Scott, I think he does genuinely love Jean.
It's a tale as old as time.
Yes, but he has his notions of what romance should be, and he should be the leader and the protector, and he can't just deal with the fact that Jean's her own person, and
She's
who's
not just her own person, she is more powerful than he ever will be.
a butt ton more powerful than he will
And
ever be.
not just as the Phoenix persona, but as maybe the most powerful telepath that's ever lived.
Exactly.
But we see this developing, like Scott gets concerned as he sees the development of Jean Grey's abilities. There's weird. So again, there's a million things that happen in these that we can't discuss, but one of them is he gets thrown off when he realizes she can change her clothes at will.
Right, and his.
And his.
Yeah. There's a scene, we're jumping ahead a little bit, but there's a scene where Jean and Scott have a little romantic, sexy time, and she uses the Phoenix power to contain, because he, you know, if he doesn't have his visor on, the concussive blast comes out of his eyes at all times. So she uses that power to contain it and lets him to just be a guy and open
Yeah.
his eyes for the first time. And he's kind of, he's in awe of that. But at the same time, he's kind of scared of it.
Right. You know, again, this is without sort of the Phoenix Force showing a true manifestation. How much of this is Jean Grey's telepathic abilities, psychic abilities, and how much of this is the Phoenix Force? And what's great is it's never explicitly defined.
Yeah, and it is at least implied that because Jean is so powerful. That she was the perfect vessel to contain the Phoenix Force.
Right. The Phoenix picked her. They didn't pick Charles Xavier.
Yeah, I do want to just kind of, you know, at least clarify. So if our listeners are familiar with the X-Men continuity, you'll know later that the identity of Jean Grey gets a little convoluted
Well,
as it goes on with the Madeline Pryors and the anyway, but at this time, right now. When this was written, and if people reading it at this time, Jean Grey is Jean Grey. There is no retcons yet.
right. This is where we're doing, as much as I'm a deconstructionist, we're doing reader response right now.
Yes.
We're doing straight reader response.
Yes. But just, I mean, it's important to the narrative of the story, I think, that the character of Jean Grey, you can't be thinking of the future and how that's going to be changed and how her character is going to change. And yeah. So anyway, that's all. Just like Jean is Jean.
Yeah.
At this time. I think that's important. Yeah.
So throughout all of this, so besides the fact that the Jason Wingrade awfulness of controlling her mind and being able to manipulate her into selling out her X-Men without or her fellow teammates without knowing it. This all culminates in a massive battle at the Hellfire Club, which conveniently the comic keeps telling us is only 4 blocks away from Avengers Mansion. I wonder why that's important. It culminates in a massive battle in which Wingrade actually transforms Jean into the Dark Queen. And at this point, it is suggested that there is some Phoenix aspects going on here. So she turns against the X-Men, and everything is dire. The fate of the world is in balance.
And this is something Claremont does really well, I believe. He does little flashbacks when he's trying to convey to you, the audience, that this is a big darn deal. He always goes around the Marvel universe. So you'll see like the Avengers.
Well, it's a great scene.
Yeah. So the Avengers are like, what's going on here?
This is later when she becomes the Dark. This isn't when she becomes the Black Queen. This is later when she manifests as the Phoenix. I know what you're talking about.
Right. Okay.
Yeah. And it's a great scene, but this isn't right. This isn't at this point in the story.
Okay. All right. Sorry. I was jumping ahead.
I know exactly what you're talking about.
Yeah. Well, anyway, just
to, I have to, a to very finish, special note about it.
Yeah. To finish that thought off, it's just something that Claremont does, not just in this story, but in multiple in other stories, when he wants to convey just how bad things are. He shows you the rest of the Marvel universe going, damn. But anyway, continue.
Because the Dark Queen isn't the Dark Queen or the Black Queen, right?
It's the Black Queen, yeah.
The Black Queen isn't Phoenix yet. It's just Wingard manipulating Jean into becoming, and this is the level of manipulation that poor Jean Grey goes through on so many levels. She gets transformed into the Dark Queen or the Black Queen to balance out Emma Frost, the White Queen, and so the X-Men are in dire shape. So Wingard, in his wisdom, decides to psychically have her kill Scott Summers. And, ooh, is that a mistake?
Yes.
Because true love wins.
As Jean explains later, that, you know, seeing that stripped away all the mental manipulation, all the mental hold that Wingard had on her. So she is able to be freed.
And so she reacts, let's say, accordingly.
Before we go any further, I do want to talk about, real quick, there's an escapade with Wolverine where he's trying to fight his way through the sewers and into, he's a badass. You know, Wolverine is not one of my favorite characters in Marvel.
In the 80s, I loved Wolverine.
Yeah, but that's what I mean. I'm looking at this and I'm like, oh, well, this is why everyone loves Wolverine. Because he's a badass and he's got the funny quips. And
it's the famous quote, right? There's a famous quote in here. Do you want me to quote it?
Quote it. Do it.
Yeah. There's a time for scrapping and a time for being sneaky. Either way, Wolverine's the best there ever is.
Exactly.
And that's Wolverine talk.
Yeah.
Wolverine is saying that Wolverine is the best there ever is. Now, this was early on, so we could put up with that crap.
Yeah. This is why you could see why he became such a fan favorite and why he became... I'm going to say something.
And he's hairy as hell.
Yes, he is. John Byrne draws him with all kinds of hair.
Shadows.
But this is before Wolverine became the Batman of of the Marvel Universe. And by that, I mean...
Fair enough. That's fair.
Yeah, he's in every team. He's in every... Everyone has to have a Wolverine somewhere.
Or he was the Deadpool of the Marvel Universe.
There you go. But anyway, yeah, there's a whole issue called Wolverine Alone, where Wolverine fights his way through the Hellfire Club.
That's where the quote comes from.
Yeah, and it's great. It's really, really good. There's this one whole part where he does a whole Dirty Harry thing on one of the guards. I know what you're thinking. Could you empty your clip into me? before I can get to you. And he's like, come on, let's see what we can do. And the guy ends up dropping his gun. And Wolverine's right. like, damn, I thought you were gonna go for it.
Still not as cool as the Indiana Jones just shooting the sword wielding guy, but
Yes, but in a similar vein. Let's continue with the story. I just wanted to point out that Wolverine is actually quite good in this.
Yeah. So we work up, and this is all part of leading up to Jean Grey breaking from the Black Queen persona. And this is what you're working up to, I think. Seeing Scott Summers die telepathically is when she breaks her connection with Jason Wingard. And she reacts appropriately with a great internal struggle. Wolverine shows up. She regains her mind. She frees Cyclops. Cyclops freezes everyone else. She confronts Mastermind. So there's a huge fight scene. Everybody's fighting. There's a hilarious bit where Wolverine lands on top of Leland, is it, who can control gravity. And Leland decides he's going to, like, get rid of gravity. Unfortunately, Wolverine is on top of him. So that's actually a funny bit.
There's one panel which I just got a huge kick out of. Cyclops, Storm, Nightcrawler, and Scott. And Colossus, I'm sorry. And it's all them sitting together, but they're not in their guises, like their superhero guys. And the caption just says, you might not recognize them. They really look like this. And it shows them all in the same positions, but with their costumes on, except Nightcrawler looks just like Nightcrawler.
Yes.
He doesn't change it anyway.
Yeah. It's kind of funny stuff, but this issue is where things, so we're in 134 by this point. This issue is where things really start to go kablooey. So what happens is Jean regains her mind, works to help the X-Men take out the Hellfire Club, which they do. And Jean confronts Mastermind, the man who has been, to be honest, pardon the language, and, you know, if you want to put a, you know, whatever here, he's been mind raping her.
Yes.
Literally, at some point, it's implied. And what she does is she infuses him with the power of Phoenix. She makes him a god, knowing that his mind cannot take it.
Shows him all the secrets and the vastness of the universe, which it's a very Lovecraftian kind of thing.
And she destroys him. She absolutely obliterates. She doesn't kill him, but he is absolutely left catatonic, drooling, and like a complete
vegetable, basically.
Vegetable, essentially. The consequence of that, taking her revenge on this man, is that she fully and 100% awakens the Phoenix.
Yes. After she does that, I think it's very telling because it's just a throwaway line, but she says, in a way, I envy your peace.
Yes.
Oh, so that's where her mind is right now. Yes, and so she fully awakens and becomes the Dark Phoenix. But I want to just point something out here. It's not in this collection, but when Jean originally became Phoenix, good Phoenix, it's the exact same language.
Mm-hmm.
Where she says, hear me, X-Men, no longer am I the woman you knew. I am fire. I am life incarnate. Now and forever, I am Phoenix. When she said that and was in the green outfit, it was a thing of hope. Like, I am the Phoenix. Hooray. It's the exact same words in the exact same pose. And it's evil. And this time, I did my homework. Mm-hmm. It's incredible. What? It's a great callback. And it's perfect. Mwah. Chef's kiss.
Yeah. And this is the end of the issue. And that leads us to the final three issues of this series, which are some of the most consequential three issues in the history of Marvel Comics. Is that hyperbole? I just wanted to say hyperbole. I know it's hyperbole. Is it hyperbole? Yes. Am I wrong?
No, you are not. In fact, I will take it a step further. This is some of the most consequential comics in comics. Not just in Marvel, yet definitely in Marvel, but this will have ramifications across comics in general.
And to be honest, still. Yes. Now that I have rejoined reading the X-Men comics, it still matters.
Absolutely.
We should get to it. So issue 35, here we go. It's appropriately titled Dark Phoenix. And this is what you were referring to earlier. Jean Grey absolutely loses control. The Dark Phoenix, or the Phoenix entity, takes over, but it's not the Phoenix entity for hope. It's the Phoenix entity of selfishness and destruction.
Destruction, exactly. And yeah. I just want to clarify something real quick, because we will get comments. It's 135, not just 35.
Oh, I'm sorry. Yeah, why did I say 135? Or why did I say? Doesn't matter. So 135, Phoenix manifests. Well, she manifests at the end of 134, but 135 is where we feel the full weight. And my God, this is a big issue. 22 pages of just insanity.
Yes, just an incredible fight scenes between Phoenix and the rest of the X-Men. And again, we got to that one point where there's just a panel of, or there's a page, I should say, of the rest. It goes around the rest of the Marvel Universe. And this is how we know that this is bad. Because you have the Fantastic Four saying, we're getting these readings. I don't know what to do. Spider-Man, his Spidey senses are going crazy. Doctor Strange is, what is it?
By the hoary hosts of Hogarth.
That's the one.
Yeah.
Yeah, and even the Silver Surfer is saying, man, this is some implications right here.
Silver Surfer's like, hey, this is a fellow traveler. Oh, wait, this fellow traveler is not on the same wavelength I am.
Exactly. And we get something really bad happens.
Yes.
So the Phoenix needs to power up.
Right. So the Phoenix powers up. She beats the living hell out of the X-Men. To be clear, does not kill them.
No.
This is important for later.
Maybe it's cliche to have the, you know, I know you're still in there. This is important. Jean is still Jean. Continue. I'm sorry. I jumped on you.
No, it's fine. Yeah. And it's, but this is important, is like, doesn't kill them, flies off into space. We get a quick interlude. And this is important, not for this series, but this is perfect. Chris Claremont, is we get a quick interlude involving Sebastian Shaw and Senator Robert Kelly. And Robert Kelly is an important person going forward. And Sebastian Shaw suggests that the way to contain them is to bring back the Sentinels.
Yes, this will be important for future days of and future that's past.
It. That's the last we hear of Sebastian Shaw or all of this other stuff in this comic. But it's that brief interlude in between one of the most horrific moments in comics, where Sebastian Shaw manipulates a U.S. senator, presidential candidate, into a thing that will have consequences to the X-verse for the rest of the life of the X-verse.
Yes. He wants to make the Sentinels great again.
Yeah. Make the Sentinels great again.
The Phoenix flies off into space and decides to power up by flying into the heart of a sun.
Because the Phoenix is hungry.
Yes.
But this is the whole concept of, like, what I was talking about before, the idea of birth and rebirth and entropy, and the Phoenix must feed, right? The Phoenix died, but then the Phoenix germinates. Phoenix rises again. I mean, this is a tale as old as mythology, right? It's a tale as old as mankind understanding mortality. It's the oldest concept of consciousness of being.
Well, it's the cyclical nature of death and rebirth,
Yes. Right.
Yeah.
But the need to be rebirthed means to feed, because you can't. It's like everything must feed, or it will wither and die once again, and whole continents buried by dust. So what the Phoenix does is it feeds, and it's gorgeous panels. I mean, my God, artistically,
woo, yeah.
Jean Grey Phoenix flying, not just through our universe, but through the entirety of all existence, right? And in the stars and amongst the planets, and you're just, I mean, imagine it. Imagine just the power, but the Phoenix must feed.
Right. And this, now we get to the power of the Phoenix. You, as you were saying, think about like the most powerful beings in the Marvel universe, Galactus or Infinity or and so forth.
Right.
And she, and the Phoenix is dwarfing those.
Right. You know? I mean, I don't know the current state of power levels in the Marvel universe. I don't even know if Galactus is still with us.
Galactus will always be with us.
Galactus will always be with us.
So, I mean, but if you think about it, Galactus can eat a planet. The Phoenix eats a sun.
Yeah.
That just says it right there. And that's exactly what Phoenix does.
The Phoenix consumes a sun, which then kills.
It causes a supernova, which destroys an entire solar system.
Right. Including 5 billion living beings.
5 billion living beings. And the implications of this in the real world was Jim Shooter, who was the executive, not the executive, but the editor-in-chief.
Right.
Stepped in and said, you can't have her kill 5 billion people and let her live. Because Chris Claremont's original plan was to redeem Jean and have her live out her life. A depowered Jean.
Yeah. Yeah. And I did read some of the history of this, and that makes sense. For all of Jim Shooter's questionable editorial
mandates. Like, yeah.
Mandates. Hey, he's not wrong here.
I'm kind of on board with him here, too.
You can't. And I think at that point, yes. And John Byrne, I think, even is quoted as saying, we imbued the Phoenix with too much power at this point. And there had to be a moment where it had to be pulled back.
Exactly. And that's kind of what this whole thing is doing, was trying to depower Jean. But they went a little bit too far. Yeah.
So not, but this is no longer Jean Grey.
Yeah, this is fully the Phoenix Force.
This is fully the Phoenix Force.
Yeah. Oh, man. Stan Lee would love that alliteration. Fully the Phoenix Force.
Essentially killed 5 billion people without really any. The Phoenix Force didn't even know it did it. Jean Grey, when she comes to later on, had no memory of this.
No.
But it doesn't matter, right? So this is an astonishingly remarkable moment in comics. We see in comics mass destruction. We see Galactus consuming a planet, which probably kills more than 5 billion people. But it feels different, doesn't it? I mean, it's weird because Galactus is a force onto its own, and Phoenix is a force onto its own. My reading of Marvel Comics has slipped so much over the years, and I've only within the past 5, 6, 7 years really revisited the cosmic aspects of Marvel. So I don't know if Galactus and Phoenix ever met.
I can't speak to that, actually. I know that Galactus is still around, but
two biggest mass murderers in the universe.
But see, I mean, yes, you are absolutely correct about that. But Galactus is sort of like an elemental force where he goes around and, you know, tries to do the Thanos thing of keeping balance.
Oh, I'm sorry. Thanos would have to be included, of course, in the equation as well.
Yeah. But the Phoenix seems to do
Well, and Death, of course, she's the biggest killer of all.
Yeah. But again, an elemental force, that is the natural progression of things. Whereas the Phoenix just seems to be wanton destruction with no redeeming.
The Phoenix is not a naturally occurring reset.
Exactly.
Does that make, do you know what I mean? It's like a reset isn't, there's a better word for that, I'm certain, but the Phoenix isn't a reset. Death and Galactus are resets. Thanos is a different thing.
But where, like I said, like the Phoenix is just chaos and destruction for no reason other than its own selfish desire.
It's selfish. Yeah. It's about feeding itself to be itself. But isn't that what we want from a life force? I mean, at the end of the day, we strive for life. You know, I mean, this is what's fascinating about the Phoenix is you and I are not killing 5 billion people to feed ourselves. But isn't that the nature of, I mean, the concept?
No, I disagree.
Consequence.
I disagree with
that. I mean, Phoenix Flames, right? I mean, it's, I'm not defending the Phoenix, Paul.
No, but what defeats the Phoenix in the end is, I know this sounds cliche, but it is love and sacrifice, which defeats the Phoenix.
Which we'll get to.
Which is what makes, you know, and as much as I'm pissed off at humanity right now, we are pretty fucking great. And it is our ability to sacrifice for others and to do for others that makes life better. With the Phoenix.
Hell with the Phoenix. But we can't quite say the hell with the Phoenix yet because we still have two more issues to deal with the Phoenix.
And one's a double size. Yeah. So the X-Men come up with this really, it's the Beast, actually.
Right. And let's go back for a minute. Earlier on, and the Beast is important here, and I understand that I'm well known as a Beast fan. It should be noted that the Beast left the Avengers to help the X-Men. So now he is part of the X-Men again.
Yes. So the Beast sees he's an Avenger and he's right. on monitor duty and he sees something really bad going on and he thinks about reporting it because that's what he's supposed to do is report it to the Avengers. And he says, you know what? No, I'm not. And he abandons
Right. He doesn't have any friends in the Avengers. He's, you know, so I assume this is before he and Wonder Man became BFFs forever.
Well, I think he just he prioritized the X-Men. Over the Avengers. He said, these are his OG. There you go. Yeah. That's it.
I realize I'm pulling back down to earth for a little bit, but it's kind of important. Even though I'm a fan of the Beast, I think he actually makes a difference in this story in some ways. Like, yeah, he left the Avengers. He deleted the alert. He protected the X-Men and then he went and joined them. And he actually has a pretty major contribution to what happens here coming up. Again, back to Phoenix eats a sun, kills 5 billion people, and is still hungry, and is now headed back to Earth.
In the meantime, the Beast has come up with a psychic dampener headset, a little, you know, a tiara.
Yes, and I believe it is called a tiara at some point. Yes. It should also be noted that when Phoenix ate the sun and killed the 5 billion people, she also engaged with a Shi'ar, bringing the Phoenix back to the attention of the Shi'ar Empire. And Professor X is X. X is X.
Yes, the XX.
The XX. But that's important.
Yes, no, it is going to be important for the
as part of the end of that particular story. So, yes, we get back to the next issue, 136. We're almost there, folks, where we have the Shi'ar Council deciding that the Phoenix must be destroyed. And so, yeah, here we get into a situation. We have a denouement of sorts, not a denouement that. Meaning the end of all things, but a, let's call it an interlude of preparation. We bring things down a little bit. The Phoenix is still out there doing Phoenix stuff, although they're heading to Earth.
Well, Jean does return to Earth, and...
Yes, but this is... Right, so the X-Men are preparing. This is where the Beast is preparing the diadem of psychic dampening.
The diadem of psychic dampening. Absolutely brilliant.
And this is where Jean comes to visit her parents.
Yes, which is kind of a heartbreaking scene.
But which also is planting the seed of humanity still within the Phoenix entity.
So it's Jean still trying to come to the forefront.
She's trying to find her humanity yet still.
But then she has her parents and her family be awful to her.
Necessarily for bad reasons.
Well...
They're terrified.
They are terrified, but then you also get the idea that they've always been terrified of her because she's different. Again, with the metaphor, the allegory that Claremont is so good at. You have this family. She's always been a little different, and the parents have never really accepted her for what she is.
This is Claremont doing some subtext.
Yeah, Claremont being Claremont.
This is some serious subtext.
Mm-hmm.
That we're reading in the midst of big giant comic book story, cosmic action.
So then we have Nightcrawler, poof.
And he as
poofs,
he does.
Yeah, he poofs in behind her and drops the diadem of dampening upon her dome.
And here's the thing is like this could like I don't want to say the X-Men are like sometimes dumb, but their timing was bad.
Well, we get it. Okay. Yes, their timing was bad. The diadem of dampening was dumped on her dome and and the X-Men have tried to fight her down.
Right.
Since she's a little bit depowered. But she, of course,
because the Phoenix has attempted humanity. The Jean Grey persona has moved not completely to the forefront, but enough to the forefront to attempt for humanity. I mean, it's really the conflict going on with Jean Grey right now is insane.
But we get to a moment where she destroys the diadem. She's going back to being repowered. And Scott nearly talks her down. Cyclops nearly talks her down to come back.
Even before that, there's one moment even before that, and I know what you mean, and this is really important, and this is like damning on Professor X.
Yes.
What you're getting to. But before that, there's a massive fight scene, and because she has the diadem of psychic dampening on her head, the X-Men actually get her into a position where one person can kill her, and that's Wolverine. The one person who will take the kill shot and should take the kill shot, and it's that one moment where Jean Grey comes to the forefront and Wolverine hesitates on the kill shot.
He doesn't want to kill his friends.
Because he sees the humanity that like manifested briefly, and so he can't do it.
Exactly. Even though she's pleading with him, just do it. You have
he's actually telling him to kill her, and he won't do it because Wolverine, of all people, sees the humanity suddenly coming through, even though the humanity is pleading with him to kill her. I mean, his claws are literally right up there. All it takes is a schnick.
And he won't do it.
And Wolverine, of all people, couldn't pull the trigger. So, which gets you to Scott actually just about to talk her down. And what asshole shows up and screws it all up?
Yes, Professor Dickhead shows up and
literally
and hits her with a psychic blast trying to subdue her, and of course it doesn't work.
My note is Phoenix is displeased.
Yes, indeed. And Phoenix reestablishes dominance of the Jean Grey persona.
Then we get something weird.
Well, we get a psychic battle, sir.
We get a psychic battle. To be honest, in comics, like I get it from a narrative standpoint, a psychic battle, it kind of feels like a letdown, right?
I don't know. It felt
like a letdown to me.
I think John Byrne does something really interesting with a psychic battle. It's not just two people with fingers against their foreheads going,
Although it is a little bit of that.
Well, but the way it's done with the, you know, the Phoenix, the bird, and the, I think it's rendered quite beautifully, but there's only so much you can do with a psychic battle. Apart from doing it like the typical thing of like, we're in another world or it's a blank void, or it's hard to do psychic battles.
Right. But what ends up happening is that Professor X wins. Now he wins because the human side of Jean Grey was fighting against the Phoenix as well. So it was almost a two-pronged attack on the Phoenix.
Yes.
And I get that. And that makes sense. But we're talking a universal level consciousness battling a human dude. And it does, I think they made it very clear that it was the combination of Professor X and Jean Grey.
And Jean Grey's resistance.
And Jean Grey's resistance. Because there's no way, even in the goofiness, wonderful goofiness of comics, that I would ever believe that Professor X alone could take out Phoenix.
No, absolutely not. And
so I appreciate that they tried to, at the end of it, be like, oh, well, but Jean Grey helped.
But it also, I think this is the way we're getting into before, where you were talking about the elemental nature of having to feed and destroy life, but it's countered by love and friendship. And I know that sounds cliche, but I also think it's awesome.
But it's a universal theme, not exhibited just in comics, but in all of the art and literature that we have had throughout.
It is love and friendship and the you know, the joy we had along the way that saves the day.
That saves the day.
Yes.
And then so Phoenix has been, so the idea is that, so Professor X and Jean Grey have worked in concert to separate the Phoenix.
Or suppress it.
And so everything is fine. Everything is perfect. And then we have a stinking marriage proposal. Because that is the first thought I would have after 5 billion people have been killed. You know, the existential threat to the entire universe is over. And the first thing we have is Scott being in his mind going, you know, doing the marriage vows. And Jean Grey waking up and saying, is that a proposal? And he's like, yes, it is. And they're like, oh, well, I accept. And oh my goodness, we're getting married. Hooray. That's weird. This is all of the goofiness of comics. This is one of the goofiest moments in comics that I've ever read.
Oh, come on.
Really? I mean, seriously.
It's okay.
Yeah, let's get married. Okay, you just committed mass genocide.
Well, the Phoenix Force did.
Let's tie the knot. I mean, is that the first thing you would be thinking of? I don't know.
Well, it would be, because I'm a hopeless romantic, whereas you are a cynical bastard.
Well, there's that too.
No, I understand what you're saying, but
it's weird. It's just weird. It's so out of character in so many ways to how the rest of this comic goes. But you know, there it is. It's like, was that, you know, Jean Grey wakes up after being saved from the Phoenix, and her first thought was that a marriage proposal?
I think it's trying to up the stakes. So this is it could have worked out as a happy ending, and every other comic in existence would have ended the story there, not Chris Claremont.
Things get worse.
Yes. Suddenly they are all transported to the blue area of the moon.
Well, they're actually transported to
the Shi'ar.
Yeah. Battleship. Yeah.
You are correct. Yes. They go to the Shi'ar battleship.
Well, the Shi'ar, who have been paying attention to all of this because, you know, the planet that was destroyed by the Phoenix was under their protectorship. And the ship that they had watching over it was also destroyed by the Phoenix. So Lalandra and the Shi'ar have, let's say, taken notice.
But we know it's a big deal because the Shi'ar, the Kree, and the Skrull have all gathered together to pass judgment.
Right. So this is where we get, like, well, the previous one was the penultimate. Now we get the ultimate. Jean Grey is to be judged. And she is found to be needing, it's found that she needed to be executed.
She's already been judged, we should say.
She's already been judged.
Yeah.
The idea is, and of course, Lalandra's sad because she and Professor X have been shtupping. So Lalandra's sad because things could have been different. Who cares? It's a bunch of emo stuff, which is very in keeping with the soap opera nature.
I kind of like the fact that two incredibly awful people found each other. That's nice. Because Lalandra is kind of a jerk too.
There's this whole bit about the Phoenix Force must be executed within Jean Grey, and therefore Jean Grey, because you nip it at the bud, right?
Yeah, if you kill Jean Grey,
go back in time and kill Hitler before Hitler becomes Hitler. Right, I mean, this is the whole idea. Professor X then invokes a duel of honor.
I don't know exactly how to pronounce this. I think it's pronounced...
I'm not even going to talk. Yeah, it's something like... and so he invokes a duel of honor. This is when Lalandra, the Shi'ar Empire, like, consults with the Kree and the Skrull. The Kree and the Skrull agree to the duel of honor. It's trial by combat. Meanwhile, the one individual, and I'm throwing out some love for my guy here. The one individual who objects to this, who is like, how dare you make this decision for all of us, and pontificates in a long bit about the nature of justice, like how all creatures need a trial, all creatures need represented, is, of course, the beast. And he goes on and on and on about it until, of course, he finds out that he gets a masseuse, at which point he says, "Oh, my stars and garters," and all is forgotten.
To be fair, they do the Duel of Honor, and we go through a, I think, is a really great segment where each member of the X-Men has, they're preparing for the duel the next day.
This is my defense of the thought bubble.
Yes. What we get is each individual X-Men character is ruminating on what the battle will mean tomorrow. And right. I think Nightcrawler is poignant because he wants to defend Jean. He wants to defend his friend. However, he's German and ruminates on the Holocaust.
Yes.
She did kill 5 billion people.
Yep.
That ain't cool. Again, Claremont. There's a lot of people who wouldn't have been brave enough to just bring that up.
Yeah. But I think, you know, it's like he could do that. He could get away with that because it's comics.
And it's important. And it's important to think about. It's an important aspect of this story.
Yeah.
That, yeah, Jean Grey did do these things, even though maybe she was mind bothered about it. Yeah. So we get each of the characters ruminating, and that's where Beast talks about justice. But justice can go by the wayside if you get a masseuse. Ooh.
Yes.
And then you get this wonderful thing where Jean decides to dress as Marvel Girl, her original costume.
Yeah. Yeah.
You sound skeptical.
Yeah, well, it's an interesting choice. What it is, like, so what she's doing is it's a reversion to a younger self, a self from before, right? This is
a time of innocence.
So
yeah,
like what she does is she pulls down, like, because she's mortified when she finds out that the Phoenix Force has killed 5 billion people.
Yes.
There's a reading here that's a little reductive.
I see what you mean, but I didn't see that. I didn't read it that way.
And I understand I'm probably bringing way more into this than what was intended, but is, like, that struck me as odd.
Okay.
And a little curious, because so she is. And especially once we know her motivation at the end of this, because her motivation has, we find out later, her motivation existed from the get-go. And I think this started when she understood, like, the genocide that Phoenix did.
I read it as this was a way to, like, return to a time of innocence, return to a time before the Phoenix and reclaim herself, her true self, before she was taken by the Phoenix. Before all the other manipulations that have been cast upon her from Jason Wingard, from Scott, from Wolverine, all that shit. Yeah. I'm going to go back to who I was and make my own decisions as myself.
When we find out later that her intent all along was the end result of this upcoming fight.
So she makes the decision as herself, not... I think we're neither one of us is right. It's just... I saw it a different way.
It's an interesting decision to make creatively when we understand what's about. Once we, like, get to the end of this, what does it mean? And you know what? It may not mean anything. Sometimes things don't mean anything. I have a hard time coming to grips with that, but sometimes things don't actually mean anything.
Yeah. Maybe it was just a way to use, you know, an Easter egg for a callback. That's all. Maybe that's it, and we should just shut up.
What happens is, so Jean dresses as Marvel Girl, and then the X-Men and the Imperial Guard are transported to the blue side of the moon. What's weird is that there are several characters we just haven't really talked about, which is weird, because Storm is one of the best characters in all of X-Men comics.
Oh, absolutely, yeah.
And she's not overly... consequential in this story arc. She plays her part and she's important in certain aspects of fight scenes.
She's cool and badass
because that's what she is and always has been and always will be, but she's not the focus here, nor is Nightcrawler. nor is Colossus really, you know, and frankly, nor is Wolverine, other than the moments where they're like trying to show that Wolverine is the best at what he is. This is a story about Jean Grey and Scott Summers.
Yes.
So we get this absolutely insane, crazy fight scene that goes on and on and on and on. I don't mean that pejoratively. I mean, it just, it goes on for many, many, many pages.
Yes. And it's great. I think it's really great.
And it's fantastic. Comics. It's a comics. It's an extended comics fight scene that could be an issue in and of itself.
And it's using, everyone gets to use their powers in unique and different ways. Mm-hmm. They get to have their powers thwarted in unique and different ways.
Yes.
Yeah. I think it's, and it's, you know, visually stunning and dynamic.
And you get some weird stuff where like the Kree and Skrull guys end up fighting with each other. It's kind of inconsequential. It's a nice nod to the issues that those two have with each other, but it really doesn't matter. Yeah. But eventually the X-Men just are losing, and they're losing badly. And the idea is if they lose, then Jean Grey will be executed. And so we get down to the final two X-Men, and guess who they are?
It's Scott and Jean.
The Last Stand.
And we find out that the Phoenix hasn't been defeated. The Phoenix has been suppressed.
Right. The Phoenix manifests itself. And what we see numerous times throughout this fight is Jean saying, kill me, in so many words.
Saying that she needs to be stopped.
Jean is doing this on purpose. All of this, the various times throughout this fight, she's essentially saying, kill me.
She is deliberately using the X-Men, getting them to fight her to weaken her.
Right.
She is deliberately trying to weaken herself.
And the question is, does she manifest because the Phoenix is in control, or does she manifest to force the X-Men's hands?
See, I think she manifests to force the X-Men's hand because she manifests as the green outfit.
Right.
Which is the good outfit.
Right.
Yes.
And she manifests in a less powerful form.
Exactly. She uses the X-Men to weaken her strength, so that she can, you know, inflict the final blow.
He literally pleads with Scott to kill her.
Yes. And Scott, of course, won't do it.
At some point. I mean, it's before this ancient weapon, just Deus Ex Machina.
Well, they do lead the seeds, because there is, they mentioned in the beginning that there are ruins and there's possible technology that's hidden beneath. Right. They do lay those seeds. So,
but she has clearly manipulated things to get to this point, and she is literally pleading with Scott to kill her.
Scott, of course, won't do it. So right. she uses this ancient weapon to annihilate herself, and thus ends the Dark Phoenix saga.
And that's it. Yeah. It's really stark, because that's it. All that's left is the notorious busybody, the Watcher, talking about it for the last page.
But this is some beautiful, yes, it's purple prose, but it's some beautiful stuff from Claremont. All beings, I'm gonna read something. All beings carry within them the capacity for good and evil. All our actions result from the interaction of these two fundamental forces. Jean Grey could have lived to become a god, but it was more important that she die a human. And that's right. The key.
And in the end, the beauty killed the beast.
She chose her humanity over over power. I think this is good stuff.
It is, and what I mean, it is interesting that the end, except for the final page of, you know, the Watcher doing what the Watcher does. It's just fade to black.
Yeah,
it's like it's literally Jean Grey gets disintegrated by that ancient weapon, and then Scott. Then there's a panel of Scott like weeping over her body or what have you, and that's it. Like, boom, fade to black. It's pretty powerful stuff. And that's it.
Yeah.
Like, never again will the Phoenix rise to bother the Marvel Universe.
It's over, and we'll never see Jean Grey again.
We'll never see Jean Grey again. We'll never see the Phoenix again, because the concept of the idea that the Phoenix rises and lives again from the ashes...
Oh, we joke and jest, my friend. Now, this story ends here. I mean, yes, things will happen in the future, because that is the nature of comics.
Right.
You know, serialized comics continue and things need to be changed and retconned and new stories need to be told. However, this story right here is the culmination of years of plot lines and soap opera type storytelling from the master Chris Claremont. And let's throw John Byrne into that mix as well.
Yeah, well, you know, I mean, it's we praise John Byrne for and we criticize John Byrne for a lot of things, but in this he is absolutely a co-plotter and his visuals are amazing. But at the end of the day, this is Chris Claremont's story. It's really powerful comic book storytelling.
And, you know, and welcome back, listeners. I know you've just finished reading this and come back and listen to us. Yes. See, wasn't it good? I told you.
But the consequences beyond this, not even taking into account Phoenix, who Marvel will never let go of. But the consequences going forward just in the regular X-Men comics before Phoenix is brought back, there's so many seeds. There's so many things that develop over the course of these issues that become massive in not just X-Men comics, but in Marvel comics, period.
Yeah, this is something that the creators will come back to again and again and again and build off of and go further. But this is when you have something perfect, you keep trying to recreate it. But I do mean that. I know we sound hyperbolic. I do think this is a perfect story.
I don't think we're being over hyperbolic, because I think the recognition of the importance of this story exists outside of our, you know, puny explication.
There you go. I think it really deserves all the praise and accolades it's gotten, and its reputation is deserved.
Yeah. So we finally, after a good one, we've taken on some heavy hitters in the past. We've avoided certain heavy hitters.
Mm-hmm.
But this was a big one. We finally pulled the trigger and took on a big one.
Yeah. And this is our first. We've done New Mutants and the Beauty and the Beast. So we've done X-Men adjacent. Yeah. But we've never done X-Men proper. And here it is.
Proper. Yeah.
Okay.
So, Paul, would you like to tell us what we're talking about next?
Next time on an all-new edition of the Collected Edition, we are going to read The Scarlet Witch by James Robinson, which is the it's a lot of what Agatha All Along was based, or at least pulled from.
Yeah. So was this before or after she got rid of the mutants?
Oh, this is way after. Yeah.
Okay.
This is during the all-new, all-different period.
Yeah.
Yes.
And nothing will ever be the same again.
So the reason I didn't have it mentioned an artist is because each issue has a different artist.
Oh, goodness gracious.
Yeah. So it's 15 issues and it's
my.
And it's a different artist every time. We'll get into it, but it's pretty interesting stuff.
Okay.
So Scarlet Witch by James Robinson. Thank you, everybody, for listening. I do appreciate you leaving comments and hearing your feedback and so forth. And so the best place to reach us as far as the socials are concerned is Blue Sky right now. That's the only place I'm frequenting for various reasons. Yeah, so get in touch with us there, or of course, go to our website, collectivepodcast.com, where you can leave comments on individual episodes.
And maybe I'll have a Blue Sky here soon.
I think that would be appropriate.
Yeah.
Anyway, thank you all for listening. And I do appreciate it. We've been inconsistent the last couple of years, but we're trying to get back on track.
Indeed.
And give you this quality stuff that we're so good at.
So providing. Famous for.
Exactly.
World famous.
Yes. Oh, man. We should just learn. We should just have a written down ending.
That would defeat the purpose.
I know. Yeah.
We read a comic. We talked about it. Thank you for stopping by.
Yes. We start out so strong and then we just sort of fade out.
In 3 weeks, we'll have another great comic to talk about. And
Yep. Excellent. So we're done. Until next time, everybody, keep reading comics.
And be well.
You've been listening to The Collected Edition, a comic book podcast. The Collected Edition is a Daddy Elk production. All materials used on the program are copyright their respective copyright holders, and no infringement is intended. If you'd like to give us your feedback, the show can be found online at our website, collectededitionpodcast.com, where comments can be left on individual episodes, or send us an email to comments@collectededitionpodcast.com.
comicbookpodcast.com. The collected edition, Comic Book Podcast, is for entertainment purposes only.
Are you not entertained?